15. June 22nd. During the week since my birthday, he has learned to walk again, but only very weakly while holding on to something. The first 3 days he tried and failed, as he had before. He was secretive about it. I do not know exactly why. Probably because he felt foolish when I saw him after he fell. Or maybe he wanted to surprise me. But I heard him from the kitchen. The thud as his feet reached the floor, and the creak of the bed as he pulled himself back. He may also have done this other times when I was outside working. I think what he was actually doing was exercising his legs, putting as much weight on them as he could, a bit more each time. And on the fourth day, he succeeded, again entirely in private. In the kitchen, getting lunch, I heard the same thud as before, but then, quite unmistakably, the sound of a footstep, then another, and a third, very slow and cautious. I felt like running in and applauding, but I decided if he wanted my approval, he would have called me. He obviously feels that it is his problem, and he is going to solve it himself. However, that left me as an eavesdropper. Apparently, he did not realize the sound could be heard in the kitchen, and, not wanting to feel sneaky, I thought I should let him know. I had settled into the custom of eating my meals, except breakfast, on the card table by his bed. So, when I brought the tray in, I took my own food off, gave him his, and said, "I thought I heard you walking." He was by this time back in the bed, but sitting up and studying a diagram he had drawn on one of his pieces of paper. He had been making drawings steadily during the past week. He was designing the water power generator. He looked up without expression and said, "It's something I have to do." He did not even seem interested, but looked back at his diagram and added, "I wish I had a book. These magazines don't tell enough." He had the copies of The Farm Mechanic beside him on the bed. "What kind of book?" "Engineering, physics, electricity. I guess it would be several books. Also a good encyclopedia. You don't have one?"
"No, but I know where there is one, in the library in Ogdentown."
"Ogdentown?
You must have passed through it when you came here. The library is the gray stone building on Court Street."
"I passed through many towns, hundreds."
"Well, Ogdentown must have been the last one."
"How far from here?"
To my joy, it sounded as if he was going to suggest going for books. "Not far," I said, "only over the second ridge."
"How many miles?"
"Well, about 20, a little over 20.
Actually, it is closer to 25. There was a pause. He ate several bites of his lunch and did not say any more. So I asked, "If we brought books from there, brought them here, would they be dangerous? Radioactive?"
"Yes."
"For how long? Permanently?" "No, they'd cool off eventually. Maybe 6 months, maybe more, maybe less. It depends partly on size."
I said, "So long?"
"That wouldn't matter too much. I could wear the suit and go and copy out what I need. Gear ratios, things like that."
"But I was hoping to read them. Still, I suppose I could wait 6 months."
"You wouldn't enjoy reading technical books."
"They have other books in the library. They have whole sets of Shakespeare, Dickens, Hardy, and poetry." As I suspected, he was not too interested in that. He ate some more and then said,
"It doesn't matter anyhow, right now at least. I can't walk that far. When I can..."
And then, because I've been thinking about it so hard, I said the wrong thing again. "But I can. If you'd lend me the suit, I could go."
I could hardly believe how annoyed that made him. I should have known, I guess, having heard him dreaming when he was sick and the way he talked to Edward. "No," he said, his voice very quiet, but angry and hard. "You could not go. Understand that. Keep away from the suit. Never touch it." I started to remind him that I had already touched it, but I caught myself in time. I realized that he probably did not remember, since he had been sick and delirious at the time. We ate on in rather tense silence, I wondering why he was still so extremely sensitive about the suit when he had found a place where he could stay.
It occurred to me that maybe he was afraid I would see the bullet holes. Yet that seemed unlikely, since I had never talked to him about his dreams. How would I know what the patches were? His lunch finished, his appetite was not impaired. He went on, sounding a little less unfriendly. In fact, he tried to smile, but still it was rather like a lecture. "You must understand," he said, "that except for ourselves, that suit is the most important thing in the world. There is no other, and no way now of making another. Except for this valley, the rest of the world, as far as we know, is dangerous and uninhabitable. I don't know how long it's going to be that way, maybe forever. But as long as it is, the suit is the only way to go out there and stay alive. The idea of taking it to get some novels, it's too foolish to consider. If you took it out and something went wrong, I could never get it back. I couldn't go out after it, couldn't even try. It would be lost forever." That is what Edward had been up against. Even some of the words were the same. Yet I could not argue. After all, it was his suit. And also, of course, what he said was true. I could survive without novels. Still, it had been a pleasant thing to think about. I'd even let my imagination run to the point of making several trips, building up a real home library. So, though I can see that it is not too practical, especially from Mr. Loomis's point of view, I will continue to hope that when he can walk better, if he goes to get technical books, he may slip in at least one or two books for me to read. That may be a less offensive idea. At the time, however, I changed the subject to something less controversial. I asked him, "How far did you walk?"
4 steps, holding on to the bed. This morning, 3 steps.
"As soon as you can do a little more, I could fix a chair for you outside on the front porch. Then you could get out of this room for a while."
"I had thought of that, and on the back porch, too, where I can see the planting."
"The corn is beginning to come up," I said. "In a few more days, I'll have to thin it. The peas and beans are in, but not up yet."
"How about beets and wheat?"
"Well, I had not planned."
"We must plan, not just for next year, but beyond. Beets make sugar. Wheat makes flour."
I'd started to say that since I could only plant and cultivate so much, I had not included beets and quite a few other things, like pumpkins, turnips, squash, and so on. There were seeds for all of them in the store, but when I had made my plans, I had not counted on the tractor.
"I know what you're thinking," he said. "There's plenty of sugar in the store, I saw that, and it keeps, but when it's gone, what then? You see, that's foolish and short-sighted." His voice had grown edgy again. He went on, "I've been lying in the bed for a long time now with nothing to do but think, and I realized that we've got to plan as if this valley is the whole world, and we are starting a colony, one that will last permanently."
It was the same thought, or nearly the same, as the one I had had when I was plowing. Yet his saying it, or the way he said it, made me feel uneasy. I'm not sure why. As I was taking the tray out, he said another thing.
"When you go to your church, if you want something to pray for, pray for that bull calf."
I said, "I don't understand." The calf seemed perfectly healthy. He said,
"When the gasoline is gone, cattle can pull the plow."
It was true that some of the Amish, being slow to change their ways, used to plow with mules or oxen. I remember seeing them when I was small. There was even an old wood and leather harness hanging on the wall of our own barn, though I had never seen it used. What he meant was that we needed to breed more cattle. And I had planned that, at least, from the beginning. He asked me to bring him a new razor and blades from the store. I did, and he has shaved his whiskers off again. It makes him look healthier,